What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Da una lontana galassia stanno per arrivare due intrepidi eroi.
Io sono Jonathan e lui è Mario. Mario e Mario, sempre vicino a voi.
E perché non vi chiamate entrambi Mario?
Due guerrieri senza macchie e senza paura.
Johnny, vai a prenderlo.
E se mi spara?
Difensori dei deboli e degli oppressi.
Guarda lui, è da ieri che sta qui, ancora non l'ha beccato.
Come ancora?
Con un destino da compiere.
Grazie per aver chiamato il servizio di robot assistenza.
Aggiustare l'universo.
Ripariamo robot, androidi, intelligenze artificiali e ogni genere di elettrodomestico.
Per favore, fermate quell'assassino.
Ma voi siete pazzi, siete dei cialtroni.
Sono del cuore, non è nessuno alla barba.
Vi prego, dovete aiutarmi.
Cielo, ma quello è un disgregatore.
Prossimamente su questi schermi.
No, veramente non si vede nulla. Si sente?
Non si vede nulla?
No, niente. È un'audioserie.
Ah, allora, prossimamente sulle vostre casse.
Vabbè, però glielo dico subito, questo intervento è fuori garanzia, chiaro?
Thank you for coming. My name is Eric Stillwell. I'm going to talk about my personal history with Star Trek, going back a long time. This year's the 55th anniversary of Star Trek, the original series. And I was only 3 years old when it started, so the very first episode I ever saw was Return to Tomorrow, when a friend of mine in grade school insisted that we go home after school to watch reruns of Star Trek at his house. And I immediately fell in love with Star Trek, My father was in the Air Force, so we lived in Idaho at the time. And we all love Star Trek. We used to play Star Trek in the streets with our models, and we would even make homemade models out of paper plates and cardboard tubes. And the street down the middle of the neighborhood would be the neutral zone. So if you crossed the street, you were in violation of the treaty. Also, during this talk, we might run out of time, so if you want to ask questions as we go, feel free to ask questions. So while I was living in Idaho, I was in fourth or fifth grade, I think, and the local TV station in Boise, Idaho, decided to stop showing Star Trek reruns, and they put on Perry Mason. I don't know if you guys know the show Perry Mason, but it was an old early 1960s black and white TV series about a lawyer. And so my friend and I collected 300 signatures and asked them to bring Star Trek back into the reruns schedule, and they actually said they would. So they sent me these publicity photos to keep us tided over until the school season started again, and then Star Trek came back onto the TV. So the very first new Star Trek series for me was the Star Trek animated series. And of course, I always loved the time travel episodes. So Yesteryear was my favorite episode of the original animated series. So as I got older, my father retired from the Air Force and we moved to Oregon, which is where my parents are from. And in Eugene, Oregon, my friends and I started a Star Trek fan club called the USS Republic. And that's a picture of me back in the day when I was a teenager. And I was captain of the ship. I had a friend named Tony who was our Vulcan first officer. And we had a lot of fun. We would go on excursions. And one of our trips was to see Gene Roddenberry when he came to Oregon on his lecture tour to show the Star Trek bloopers and talk about his work with Star Trek. And so in 1980, I became the head of the Starfleet International Fan Club, and Gene Roddenberry agreed to be an honorary member of the club, along with Susan Sackett, who was his executive assistant. So that was the beginning of a sort of professional relationship that we had with the production offices in Hollywood. Just 7 years later, I had graduated from college. I went to Hollywood with my flock of seagulls haircut and my mullet, and I was hired to be a production assistant on The Next Generation. And production assistants basically are gophers who go for this, go for that, and run errands all over the studio, delivering scripts, delivering memos. I mean, things are different now because everything's electronic and through email, but back in those days, we had to deliver physical copies of the scripts and the memos and everything. It was even like really before email became very popular. So then in 1989, I got promoted to script coordinator on the series, Next Generation, and I became responsible for working with the writing staff to proofread all the scripts, get them printed and distributed to the entire cast and crew. There's over like 300 people involved in these productions, plus the executives at the studio and other places like research departments and post-production facilities. So we had to make sure that we were constantly updating people with the scripts and the revisions, because you can go through maybe 20 sets of revisions in one episode if there's a lot of changes to be had. Closer?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody can hear okay?
Too much.
Too much? Oops. Okay. All right. So then later that year, I co-wrote the story for Yesterday's Enterprise with Trent Canino, who had submitted the original spec script But he and I were working on some other ideas, and we ended up combining one of my ideas with his story idea to become Yesterday's Enterprise after we had seen Denise Crosby at a Star Trek convention in San Jose, where she said to me, you should write a story for me to come back on the show. And we're like, but you're dead. So we came up with this idea that in Trent's original script for Yesterday's Enterprise, there was no time alteration. It was just they showed up, and there was a dilemma about sending them back, because if they knew what happened in the future, it might affect the timeline, and that was the dilemma. In the revised story, we created an alternate universe, and Tasha was back on the Enterprise, and it creates a whole new difficulty in writing the story, because how do we know that the timeline has changed if everybody has been changed along with it? So Michael Piller, who was the head writer on the show, said, well, maybe Guinan's species has a sixth sense about things in time. And so that became the way we were able to have one of the characters convince Captain Picard that they needed to send the ship back in time. And one of the justifications that Trent and I came up with for Tasha to go back with them was that Captain Garrett got killed in our time, so they needed to somehow balance the timeline and send another person back to the past to give them an equal chance of fulfilling their mission back in time. Michael Piller said, that's crazy. In fact, even in the scene where Tasha is trying to explain to Picard why she should go back, he says, this makes no sense at all. And I thought, that's Michael Piller talking to me. But the show became very successful. It was Trent and I wrote the story, but almost the entire writing staff worked on the script, because they had to work over the American Thanksgiving holiday to get it done in time, to get it into production, because Denise Crosby and Whoopi Goldberg were only available in one brief time period at the beginning of January, and originally they weren't gonna shoot it until March, so they had to speed up the whole process. But it came out okay in the end, and everybody was happy. In fact, the show, this episode, was nominated for 3 Emmys. It was nominated for music composition, sound mixing, and sound editing, and it actually won the Emmy for sound editing. And this is me with Michael Piller and his wife, Sandra, at the 42nd Annual Primetime Emmy Awards. So that was pretty exciting, even though I didn't personally win an Emmy. My show won an Emmy, so. Thank you. So during the break between seasons, back in the good old days, when TV shows like Next Generation did 26 episodes per season, compared to 10 now, we basically worked almost the whole year round, except for a short break that would be somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks long in the summertime. So during one of those brief breaks between seasons in 1991, they were filming Star Trek: The Undiscovered Country, Star Trek VI, and I got to be a Klingon, Kopla. and so did Trent, my writing partner from Yesterday's Enterprise. In the top left corner, he was one of the Klingon judges in the courtroom scene where Kirk and McCoy are on trial. And you, when you see it in the movie, it looks like a very dark hole in the wall with maybe, there's 3 Klingon judges, but only the one in the center had dialogue, and Trent was just on the side, because none of us had lines. We were just extras. And this is me down in the bottom left corner with my rubber mask, because background people don't get to have real prosthetic makeup, so it wasn't real makeup, it was just a mask. The cool thing that did happen, though, while we were shooting this was Sarek, what's his name?
Mark Leonard.
Mark Leonard came for a costume fitting while we were having lunch one day. And so we were talking to him, and he said to me that my outfit, the leather part of it, looked like his costume from Planet of the Apes. Because he was General Urko, right, in the TV series Planet of the Apes. And so I asked the assistant director where the costumes came from, and they said there were so many Klingons in the scene and they didn't have time to make new costumes that they actually borrowed pieces from other studios, including the studio that made Planet of the Apes. So it's very possible that I was wearing a Planet of the Apes costume in Star Trek. It was kind of fun. Then in 1994, my writing partner David George and I co-wrote the story for Prime Factors on Star Trek Voyager. It was a first season episode, and we were actually writing the story before they had cast the roles of all the characters, so we didn't really have any idea in, like, who would be playing these parts. And it's kind of hard to write for characters that haven't existed yet, but it was something that we came up with because I thought I remembered the episode Assignment Earth from the original series, where they discover Gary Seven on Earth trying to prevent a nuclear war. And at the end, he beams away from Earth so distant into the galaxy that Scotty says it's so far that our sensors don't even reach where he's from. So I thought, well, what if the Voyager crew met these people on the other side of the galaxy that have this technology that could help us beam back to Earth? So we were pitching this idea to Michael Piller, and of course he was like, he doesn't want to use any gimmicks from the original Star Trek. So we basically had to avoid any references to Gary Seven, but we still had the same idea. And in the episode, you will remember the spatial trajector that Harry Kim used when they went to the other planet that was 40,000 light years away or something like that. And of course, these people didn't want to share their technology, so that became sort of a reverse Prime Directive story. Now, the interesting thing, if you've seen the new Picard series, it turns out that my aliens in my episode were assimilated by the Borg, and they stole the technology. And in the episode, Picard uses it to transport across the galaxy. So there's a little connection. I didn't get any credit for it, but no, just kidding. Yeah, or money. So for a few years, I was running Star Trek conventions along with Lolita Faggio, who all of you know. Lolita and I have been friends since almost the very beginning of Next Generation, so like 35 years. We ran a convention at the Royal Albert Hall in London in 1995. When the first Next Generation movie was premiering in London. So we arranged for the entire cast, except for William Shatner, to come to come to London. Well, we invited him, but it's a long story. Anyway, negotiations with his lawyer didn't work out, so we ended up just using the Next Generation cast at the convention, and it was really the most amazing convention. Over 10,000 fans were in attendance, and it was pretty exciting. And for a couple years, Lolita and I also produced several other conventions under the banner of Horizon Conventions in Oregon, Washington, and California. But right around this time, Next Generation was finished because we had already done the movie convention. And the access to the fans through television completely dropped off, so it was hard to promote conventions after the Next Generation was off the air. So the convention business sort of dropped a lot, and I ended up going back to work for Michael Piller at the studio. In 1997, I was the off-screen typing stand-in for Benjamin Sisko's alter ego, Benny Russell. And you may remember in the episode where he's typing at that old 1940s typewriter, and he's typing about how Captain Sisko sat by the window looking out from Deep Space Nine. But Avery obviously wasn't the one typing, so they had me come in to do the typing when the camera was really close up on just the keys. So I was basically playing Avery Brooks' character. I had to memorize a line. But then I was practicing on this 1940s typewriter, and if you've ever typed on an old typewriter, you know that if you type too fast, the keys all stick together. So I was trying to type as fast as possible, but I knew they wanted it to be faster. But then they bring the camera over, and if this is the typewriter, the camera thing is this big, and it's like right in front of the typewriter, and I'm trying to type like this. And the director, I think it was Dan Curry, who was directing the visual effects, was like, well, first I said to Avery, because Avery was directing the episode, I said the dumbest thing I've ever said. I said, Avery, what's my motivation? And he puts his hands on my shoulder, and he's standing behind me, and he's like, you're a writer, write. So I'm like, the visual effects director was Dan Curry, and he wanted the typing to be faster. And I said, well, it can either be faster or it can be accurate. Like, if you don't want typos, I'm like, can't you just speed it up in post? So maybe they did. I don't know. But that was fun. And also, later the next year, Armin Shimerman and I worked with David George to write the Deep Space Nine story for the 34th Rule, which became a New York Times best-selling novel. Later in 1998, I was still working for Michael Piller, and he was the executive producer and writer of Star Trek Insurrection. So I was working closely with him as the script coordinator for the movie. And Michael was also writing a book about the making of the movie. And so I typed the entire manuscript for the book and the script for the movie and did all the revisions with Michael. And that was also an interesting experience. Deborah and I went out, well, I did, I don't know. Did you go to the set? We went to one of the locations where they filmed the Baku Village in Westlake Village. And they had these giant things of rocks that they were using for the sets, but they had some leftover ones that they didn't need. So I said to the set guys, what are you going to do with these river rocks? They're these like giant rocks. And it was on a pallet with a wire cage all around it. They said, oh, we're just going to throw it away. I'm like, what? So we got permission to take this whole pile of rocks to our house in Santa Clarita, and we built a waterfall in our backyard with the Star Trek rocks. By this time, I was working with Michael Piller, and we had left Star Trek to go work on The Dead Zone and some other projects that Michael wanted to develop. But in the final episode of Star Trek Enterprise, when the crew are all in the Federation Council chamber, there's a conversation between Travis Mayweather and the other characters about how Captain Stillwell has offered him a position on his own ship. So I had a character named after me, which was kind of cool. And I think that's pretty much my slideshow. So I'm gonna just open it up for questions so I can answer any questions that you have about Star Trek and the history of the production for Next Generation and Voyager and Deep Space Nine. I have 24 minutes, so you gotta ask questions.
Wow.
Anyone have a question? Okay.
Okay, so in the beginning of your work as a professional Star Trek person, you said you were a PA at first.
Yep.
And was that directly related to your meeting Roddenberry or any cast members through conventions, or did you just apply, or how did that first step happen?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay. So what happened was I wanted to get into the business, and one of the things I thought, well, so what happened was I read in the newspaper in my hometown of Eugene, Oregon, that Warner Brothers was coming to Oregon to film a TV movie for Hallmark Hall of Fame called Promise, starring James Garner and James Woods and Piper Laurie. And so I wrote to the Warner Brothers production team and asked, can I be a production assistant on this movie in Oregon, because I live here and I, you know my way around. And at first they were like, no, we don't really do that. But I kept hounding them. I kept calling down to Burbank and asking to talk to the production manager. And finally, when they said, you know, when we get to Oregon, call us again. So when they got to Oregon, I called them and they said, all right, you can come in and help around the production office, answer phones, and make copies of scripts, whatever, and for free. I was going to work for free, so I'm like, yes, thank you. So the first location was based out of Salem, Oregon, which is 60 miles from where I lived. So they actually agreed to pay for a motel room so I could stay in the town. And I started helping around the office, and then the transportation or locations manager said he needed help because he just had so much going on with like scouting out the locations and trying to put together maps so the crew and everybody would know where to go. And since I was familiar with the area, I helped him make the maps and get everything organized. And I literally like the next day, one of the assistant directors on the movie got fired. And they said, we need a production assistant on the set to help the other assistant director. So they hired me, and I actually got paid. So that, like 2 days into it, I actually got hired to work on this TV movie. And one of the exciting jobs of filming at night out in the country near a lake is they needed someone to stand on the road like a mile away in the dark and stop traffic when the camera was rolling so there wouldn't be any sound disturbing the camera. So I spent like a couple of nights like laying on the back of a camera truck, like, because there was no traffic in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere. So that was really glamorous. But, you know, one of the things I ended up doing was they had just started using videotape to show dailies, because they had to fly it down to LA every day and fly it back up to Oregon. It was very old fashioned, but they didn't have any VCRs. So I worked in a video store then, because I was in college. So I got these video machines from my work and hooked them up for the executive producers in their hotel rooms. And one of the executive producers was James Garner, and the other one was the father of Denise Crosby's stand-in on Next Generation. So when I finished when we finished and wrapped up that production, I was driving home from the production literally on the last day, and I heard on the radio that Paramount was going to do a new Star Trek, and the producers had invited me to fly back to California with the with the whole crew for the wrap party in Los Angeles. And so while I was in Los Angeles, I contacted Susan Sackett, who had worked with Gene, was still working for Gene, and she I had a resume that I made at last minute with my one credit on it, and she forwarded it to Bob Justman, who was one of the producers on the original series and Next Generation, and he, a few months later, called me in for an interview after I had moved back. Well, I wasn't even in LA yet, But I got called for an interview because I had gone down to Los Angeles to take a test for the assistant director's training program because I thought I wanted to be an assistant director. And I was going to try to do that. But there were like thousands and thousands of applications for just a few positions. So, but while I was in LA for this, I got a call from Bob Justman saying, come in for an interview. And I went in for an interview, and he literally didn't ask me any questions. He just talked the whole time about what it's like working in production and television. One of the things I remember him saying is, if you want to be a producer in this town, the fastest way is to be a writer. I thought, well, that's interesting. And then I went back to Oregon. I got this lovely letter from him explaining that they had hired someone else to be... They hired two production assistants, but they had hired two other people because the other two had already worked at Paramount and knew their way around the lot and knew all where all the buildings were and all that. So I made up my mind to move to L.A. and find a job at Paramount as a tour guide or whatever, work in the mailroom. I would do anything. I got a job as a tour guide after 7 attempts. And I got around it because I think when you go through the HR department, they just don't care like who you are or whatever. But this time I found out who the head of the department was and like contacted them directly with my resume, and so I got called in. They hired me as a tour guide, and I for a couple of months, it was like August of 1987, I was giving tours of the studio and also working on live productions like Family Ties and Cheers and shows with live audiences where we had to manage the audiences and bring them in and show people where the bathrooms were and stuff like that and keep people quiet while their cameras are rolling and all that. So I got to do that for a couple of months, and then my boss called me in one day in September and said, the Star Trek producers are having a screening of the new pilot for Star Trek The Next Generation for the cast and crew in one of the theaters on the Paramount lot, and they need 2 pages to do door duty and check the names off the list. So I'm like, okay, sure. And then the best part was, and after you get everybody in, you can stay and watch the pilot episode. I'm like, oh my God. This is amazing. And so I'm standing out there, and we're checking off everybody, and this one guy came up, and I couldn't find his name on the list. His name was Rick Berman. I said, you're not on the list. I can't let you in. And finally someone said, oh, he can go in. I'm like, all right. But then Bob Justman came up, and he says to me, Eric, what are you doing here? And I'm like, oh my God, Bob Justman remembers my name, but I was wearing a name tag. And I said, well, I'm working as a studio page. And he said, well, I haven't seen you around. And I said, well, you know, the sets are closed, and I'm trying not to be a nuisance. And he's like, well, I'm glad you found a job at Paramount. Literally, like, the next day, I get a call from Bob Justman saying, one of our PAs just got promoted and is going to be working in our post-production with our post-production team, so we need to hire a new PA. Are you still interested? And I said, yeah. But being a sort of naive kid from Oregon, I had this old Midwest mentality that you have to give 2 weeks notice to your current employer, and I wanted to do all the right things. And Bob Justman said to his assistant, Carol Eisner, he goes, Carol, do you still have that pile of resumes? She said, yeah, they're under my desk. And he's like, can you bring them in here for a second? And the pile is like this tall of people who wanted to be production assistants on Star Trek. And so Bob says to me, okay, if you're not interested, we can find someone. I'm like, I'll be there. And it was like I started at like 6 a.m. the next morning as a production assistant. That's a long answer to a short question, but that's how it happened. I It's all about, well, I once asked DeForest Kelly for some advice, and DeForest Kelly told me the key to success in Hollywood is persistence, persistence, persistence. So I persisted, and I got to do it. Any other questions? Yes?
I was curious about that you said that you produce conventions. Was it like your profession yesterday?
Only for a couple of years. I started out working for another company called Creation that had been running conventions all over the United States. And so when I worked for them, I was an MC and would fly to different cities on the weekends. Well, in the beginning, I was actually still working at Star Trek when I would go on the weekends to help do the conventions, and sometimes I would be a guest. And then they hired me because I realized around the time that they started to do Deep Space Nine, they wanted everyone to do twice the amount of work for the same amount of money. And I'm like, I think I'm going to go do something else for a while. So I started doing conventions for Creation for a couple years. And then I started my own company with Lolita. And Lolita and I produced some pretty cool events. But it didn't last long because the ratings after Star Trek left the air, that was the primary way of advertising. It was commercials on TV in the major markets like Seattle, San Francisco. The West Coast of the United States had the highest ratings for Next Generation of any cities in the whole country. But after the show was gone from the new episodes, the viewership dropped off, and so we couldn't reach as many fans to come to the conventions.
But I don't think you said it, but Starfleet, which was the fan club that you were running, is the biggest ever?
It was listed by the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest science fiction. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was pretty cool. Thank you. Thanks. More questions?
Yes.
I understood you are a lifelong fan of Star Trek. That's what I gather.
Yes.
Could you explain to us what to you was the fascination of Star Trek in the beginning and maybe how it changed over the years for you when working and being involved on the inside?
Well, I think from the very beginning, when I was only like 10 years old, I was fascinated with the diversity of the show. Because I grew up in the military where our neighbors were all different races and different cultures. And because a lot of the airmen married, you know, people, women from other cultures, from Japan or Germany or wherever. So a lot of my friends growing up had diverse backgrounds. And then when my father retired and we moved to Eugene, Oregon, which is like 99.9% white people, I'm like, what happened to all the diversity in the world? And so I think that was something that appealed to me about Star Trek, and also the hopeful future that we can be better than we are now was the key thing about Star Trek that attracted me. Plus, it was fun when I was 10 years old to fly around with my model Enterprise. We used to get these giant jars and put ant farms in them so you could see the ants building their networks. And those were the star bases that we would visit with our spaceships. Does that answer your...
Did this kind of fascination change for you over the years, now that you have an insight?
Well, it did change. My love for Star Trek is still the same, but the perspective changes when you work on a project professionally, because there was a lot of conflict going on with Next Generation at the beginning between David Gerald and DC Fontana and Gene Roddenberry. There was some bad blood going on, and there were some lawsuits, and a bunch of people left, a bunch of new people started. So in the very beginning, when I was a production assistant, there were people saying, don't talk to those people, don't. And to me, it was a disassociation from what my idea of Star Trek is, because you can't expect people in the 20th century to be what your vision of Star Trek is in the future, because people are still people, and there were still all these personality conflicts and political power struggles. And so working in the industry gives you this whole different perspective that the industry in general is, as Chase knows, it's political, it's all about power and money and who gets to make the decision. So sometimes I would say to fans, be careful what you dream of, because it could be a nightmare. But I still will never regret working on Star Trek. It was my dream come true to do that. And I have a lot of wonderful memories. And of course, now I get to, you know, come to conventions and meet fans from all over the world. And I love it. Love it, love it. Yes.
Okay. So what is your either favorite or most intense memory from behind the scenes in your time
at Star Trek? Great. I'm not even sure I could tell. No. Well, she said most intense. Well, I'll tell you my worst intense experience, and then I'll tell you my best one. I majored in political science, so I understood the dynamics of politics, but the Paramount Studios was so political, and there was this issue about a photocopy machine that we were supposed to be getting in our building in the writing department, and one of the studio executives came over, and she wanted to see where it was going to go, because she didn't really want to approve it because it was expensive, but because we were Star Trek and we were successful, we were going to get this machine. And in the room where it was supposed to go, there was this one panel where all the electrical and telephone lines, and we weren't allowed to block this panel. And I will admit that when I was younger, I had a short fuse and a fiery temper. So I was explaining to her and Mary Howard, who was our production manager or producer, that we couldn't put anything on this one wall because we can't block the panel. And the studio executive says to me, "I know what's behind the damn panel." And I just looked at her like, "What did I do like to deserve that?" So I just stormed out of the room. "I'm not going to talk to you." Went back down to my office, which was right underneath, and I slammed the door. And if you've been in the Hart building, you know the whole building could fall down in an earthquake, right? The elevator in that building was smaller than the elevators in this hotel. That's how small it was. And anyway, the whole building could hear the door slam. And of course, about 10 minutes later, the phone rings. And I'm thinking, I know exactly what this is going to be. And it was Rick Berman's office calling to say, "Rick wants to see you in his office." And I'm like, fine. Like, I was so fed up with the BS of it. I thought, if this means I'm fired, fine, I'm fired. I'm just not putting up with this anymore. So I went over to Rick's office. I went in. He said, "Have a seat." I'm like, "I don't want to sit." I said, "What do you want?" I did. I was always terrified of Rick Berman, but finally I was just like, I've had it. He wasn't there. He didn't know what happened. So he said, "Well, you know, if you're going to be rude to studio executives, you're going to find your ass out on the street." And I said, "Are you threatening my job? Because I will go right now and report it to the union." And Rick's like, "Calm down, take a breath." And I like, and so he finally just said, "Go back to your office." So I went back to the other building, and I went in to see Michael Piller, who was my boss. And Michael and Rick had the same title. They were both executive producers on the show. And I said to Michael, can I talk to you? And he could tell I was all like worked up. So he said, come on in. What's going on? And I told him the whole story. And then he got angry that the studio executive had gone over his head because I worked for Michael, not for Rick. So he called her up and like yelled at her on the phone while I was sitting in his office. And then I felt better. She never talked to me again after that, but that was fine with me. And then the best experience I ever had was after Next Generation, or after they finished filming Yesterday's Enterprise. I got one of those calls from Susan Sackett saying, Jane Roddenberry wants to see you in his office. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? Like, every time a producer calls and says they want to see you in their office, it's usually not a good thing. But it was basically a trick to surprise me and Trent with a screening, a private screening with Rick Berman, with Gene Roddenberry and the writing staff of our episode of Yesterday's Enterprise, which was the first time we got to see it with Gene. And they had this big cake, and it said, congratulations, Eric and Trent. And that was really like the coolest thing that ever happened to me.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. 3 minutes, if there's any more questions. 3 minutes. Any more questions?
I have one more.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So, in all of Star Trek, what is your favorite episode and why?
Well, I always say Yesterday's Enterprise. Well, from the original series, I still think City on the Edge of Forever is probably my favorite because it kind of inspired the idea for Yesterday's Enterprise. Because in the original story that I was working on, the Enterprise D was going to go back to the Guardian planet with Sarek because a Vulcan archaeological team was researching ancient Vulcan history. And in the process, an accident occurs, and Surok, who is the founder of Vulcan philosophy of peace and logic and all that, gets killed. So the Vulcans turn into the violent Romulan-like race that they were in ancient times, and they team up with the Romulans and are at war with the Federation and are about to win the war. And it was Guinan, I think, who has to convince... Sarek has to convince Picard that this isn't supposed to be happening because he was down on the planet when the time change happened and people on the planet weren't affected by the time change. But Picard and everybody else thought that Sarek was a Romulan spy who was trying to destroy the Federation using the Guardian. So Sarek ends up doing a mind meld with Picard Picard realizes that this is all an accident and they have to send Sarek back in time. And when I was a kid, I used to say, you know, Sarek and Surak, they all sound like the same person. Like, what if it really was the same person? And Sarek went back in time and became Surak and was really the founder of Vulcan philosophy. But when we pitched that idea to Michael Piller, he said, I don't want to do any gimmicks from the original story. But that was one of the ideas that we developed for Yesterday's Enterprise.
Okay, so
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificas.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificas.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. L'autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Blocco 1, pronto. Blocco 1, posizionato.
Potenza erogata, 23%. Così.
Blocco 2, è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2, posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Allarme rosso, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate!
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.